Right. It is on.
Okay. Okay, so today, to pick up from where we last left off, we sort of ended in the middle of the 19th century. Okay. What I want to do today in the remaining time, so it'll be about 90 minutes, I guess, is to basically talk about what happened to philosophy and social theory over the last 150 years, where in a sense is where all the action is. Now, when we last left the story, we were talking about largely sort of the German side of the story with the development of the universities and so forth. We had gotten up to that point, didn't really talk very much about the development of social science, except a little bit about maybe some remarks about Weber and his connection as a German academic, but really not getting into the social science side of it. And so maybe the best thing to do would be to sort of begin with that, and then we'll move on from there. Now, the issue about the social sciences as an autonomous body of knowledge, that's kind of, in a way, what's at stake here, because from ancient times, you might say it's pretty easy to sort of trace the lineage of the humanities on the one hand and the natural sciences as well. And of course, if you go to Greek times, right, that's pretty obvious. And in a sense, social sciences seem to occupy a kind of in-between space that's not very clear and really isn't really explicitly represented as such until the 18th century. Okay, in some form. What this reflects, I think, is that there is a kind of, you might say there's a sort of classical conception of knowledge that the social sciences challenges in a very fundamental way. On the one hand, there's always been the humanities, and you might say the humanities have been concerned about human beings, and of course, to a certain extent, they have been. But typically, the way in which the humanities has been conducted has been through the study of the elite products of human beings. So we read the classic texts, right? And as you probably know, even in Britain, in the philosophy curriculum, until the early 20th century, if you studied, you know, you didn't start off studying philosophy at Oxford. You studied the greats, which were the classics, and what was modern was like John Locke. Okay, who's an early 18th century figure. So this idea of studying sort of the elite works that have a certain kind of longevity, right, that has been sort of, you know, so when one studies human beings, you might say one studies the best products. You know, nowadays we talk about best practice often in management and things like this. Well, the best products of the human race. We don't want to deal with the dregs, okay? And of course, obviously, this biases what exactly you're looking at as constituting the nature of humanity, right? So you're looking at works by men, okay? They're written works. And there is a privileging of old over new, no doubt about it, right? So all of those things have been very much part of the kind of classical humanities as a representation of what human beings are about. And there is still a very strong remnant of that sensibility when you hear people, especially when they're trying to say negative things about the social sciences, to say, well, look, you know, you can learn more about the human condition by reading Shakespeare or Goethe or somebody like that than by looking at a survey. In fact, some of you people probably believe this, and I'm going to ask you to raise your hands. But the thing is that is an old humanistic sort of hangover, right, where in a sense you don't actually have to talk to human beings. You just need to read the best product. And in fact, talking to human beings could kind of get in the way of figuring out what humanity's about. Okay? This is because the notion of humanity that the humanities have traditionally pursued has been a very strongly normative notion, obviously, right? A certain kind of idealized conception. And not surprisingly, because the context in which the humanities were studied and promoted wasn't the context of teaching the next generation of leaders in a society, very much like a liberal arts curriculum, right? That's where the liberal arts curriculum comes from, basically. It's from that, and not surprisingly, that has had a very strong humanistic base. Okay? So that whole, there's a sense in which what the social sciences are doing in the course of its history is sort of challenging all of that. That, you know, challenging the idea that the best way to understand human beings is just by looking at the most elite products. So, for example, I mean, if you look at our sociology department today, which actually has a very strong, you know, the people who are still the humanists are the so-called theorists, right? And the theorists read books and only deal with great people and all the rest of it. But the interesting thing about it is that within sociology and the social sciences generally, this kind of approach doesn't get, you don't get trained in it. It's a very interesting feature, right? And it's one of these things, and it's an issue that becomes, is some controversy within our own department about whether we should actually train people in these more humanistic approaches. Because who knows how to read theory anyways? You just sort of free associate, right? Isn't that the idea? And if you're smart, you do it well. And if you're not, you do it poorly. And this is a very classical humanistic way of going about business, right? It's not a very social science way of going about business. Social science, in fact, one of the important points about methodology in the social science is it's meant to correct prejudice, right? And prejudice that comes from example, for example, by just thinking human beings are exemplified by a few great guys who said a few profound things several thousand years ago. Okay? So you have to correct prejudices. And of course, if you're a field inquirer, you know, imagine yourself, you're a social scientist, let's say, studying poverty or studying someone from, you know, who's a different race of yours, or a different class of yours, you know, a different gender of yours. The odds are, especially, you know, if we're talking about the social sciences up to about maybe a generation or two ago, the likelihood is you as social scientists are probably a different kind of person from the person you're studying, right? With all kinds of prejudices and fears and conceptions and things like this, right? So you're some white guy from Harvard going into a black ghetto. Oh my God, right? Now, so what methodology does, right, it's supposed to kind of, you know, controls on the way you look at things, right, forces you to sort of systematize the way you're observing and conceptualizing, right, so that the kind of most natural response you might have to the environment isn't the one that ends up getting registered, right, that there's some sense in which you take some care, you're reflective, you're self-critical, right? And this is true of both the qualitative and the quantitative approaches. No, you know, both of them have been devoted to this. Okay? I mean, I really want to stress this, because you may recall in the first class, I gave you this little story about how you end up getting these qualitative ethno-methodological techniques out of phenomenology. And that story, whatever one wants to say about it, is obviously a story where one is in some sense bracketing and being self-critical and trying in some way to control the nature of the observation that you're having. And so, from a qualitative standpoint, I think it's quite easy to understand the point I'm making here. But I want to stress this point in particular with regard to the quantitative methods. Because the whole idea of counting people is a very politically significant act. Because basically what it means is you treat everybody equally. You might be treating them equally with respect to rather coarse-grained categories, like their age or their gender or their income level or something like that. But nevertheless, you're treating them equally, and you want to get as many of them as possible. Or if you can't get them, if you can't get an entire population because they're too vast, you start worrying about the degree to which you're missing out people because you're only dealing with a sample. And so a lot of statistical methodology is precisely devoted to these issues about reliability and validity, which you would not have in the first place as a concern if you weren't really interested in getting everybody into the picture. And so I want to stress that as a very important feature of quantitative methodology, because the idea of actually going out there and counting people, I mean, you think about it, it's very, you know, I guess the way you could see this most easily as a kind of profound thing is by the role the census has played in empowering people. Going door to door, counting people and so forth, and getting a sense of what the distribution of different kinds of people are in the country has an enormous amount of political weight in terms of how you set policy priorities, in terms of thinking about who ought to be participating in the political process. Right, these are all very profound kinds of things. And particularly when various interest groups have been interested in mobilizing a constituency to say, look, we're not being adequately represented in the legislature, we're not being adequately represented in the laws, having that quantitative data is incredibly important, and as you know, it's very important today. And think tanks, you know, that's what they sort of collect this stuff, and there's a lot of incentive within social science funding councils throughout the world to do quantitative research precisely for this reason. The people who are encouraging this research generally have some kind of interest in democratization. They, of course, have an interest in control, no doubt about it, but they have an interest in democratization as well, and the two things go together. Okay, the two things go together. Because, you know, what are you democratizing with respect to? What is the sphere of control, over which we're talking about the people? Right? What is the bounded space here? Right? So obviously the issue of representation and control go together. And social sciences, their development has been very much tied to this, and you would not have gotten this through the humanities at all. This is not to say that a person who is purely humanistically trained could not actually provide just laws, right, and be nice toward people, right? But it would be basically on the it would not be on any empirical basis, right? And so it would be very difficult under those circumstances to actually enact legislation that had any kind of experimental force. That's to say, where you're concerned about the degree to which what you're putting forward actually has the kind of impact you're interested in, and then if it doesn't, you get to change the policy. Right? That is something that's very difficult from the standpoint of a sort of purely humanistic approach to legislation. You know, so for example, you know, if you look at the way, and this is really quite interesting in a way, because this point that I'm raising here is one of the things that distinguishes the 18th century Enlightenment view about how you relate to rulers. If you're a person of knowledge, you're an enlightened guy like Diderot or Voltaire, right? How do you relate to rulers? Well, you're still relating to rulers pretty much as the humanist, right? So you want to basically go for your benevolent despot, right? Benevolent despot is this guy who is the ruler, the king, he's got absolute power, but he's an enlightened guy because he's got you breathing down his neck as the enlightened person. And this guy will then make all kinds of policies and things that will be beneficial to the people. Not because the people are telling him to do it, but because this philosopher has convinced him, you know, on the basis of first principles about what is a just society or what are people about, you know, this kind of stuff, right? On those, in that basis, that is the way you rule. And the benevolent despot will be persuaded by the argument and say, you're absolutely right, Voltaire, here I go. Okay? But that won't have anything to do with consulting people. There will not be focus groups. There will not be surveys. Right? And in fact, if the things don't work, you know, so for example, as often happened, when these benevolent despots, let's say, you know, Voltaire's telling me we need more schools. So let's start educating people. And then people get educated, and lo and behold, they want to get they want representation in government. And then what's gone wrong here? Do the people not understand? You know, this is for their enlightenment, not for them to take control of the government. You see, and then, of course, reaction can set in. And actually, Germany, if you look at Germany in the first half of the 19th century, we talked a little bit about this last time, that's kind of the story, where you had some of the benevolent despots there at the end of the 18th century, right? And then what happens is you actually start to get a flourishing of learning and so forth, and boom, people all of a sudden start having ideas of their own. Oh my God. What is the benevolent despot to do? Turn over the government to the people? I don't think so. Okay, so that's a very humanistic way of operating, you know, where you think you know what the first principles are, you have these very enlightened views, and in fact the views may be, in a sense, the right views from a kind of liberal society standpoint. I mean, a lot of these things that people like Voltaire and Diderot stood for were in fact, you know, human rights and all this kind of stuff. The problem is, right, they treated this as kind of unconditional, it gets spread to the people, but then the people interpret it in a certain way and want to do something on the basis of that. But if there's no mechanism in the government for gauging the impact of legislation, right, to correct it, you know, or in some way to modify it in some systematic way, right, then you get these kinds of impasses between the ruler and the ruled, which often lead to revolution and repression and stuff like that, which happened a lot in the 19th century as more and more people were in fact finding out about how the world works. Well, so this approach, this humanistic approach to enlightenment, is to be contrasted with a more social scientific approach, which was kind of what the idea of what the utilitarians in Britain were trying to do. So we only are moving now, let's say, a few decades, maybe 4 or 5 decades, from the time of Voltaire, Diderot, to the time of Bentham, and of course a couple more decades to John Stuart Mill. And here we've got a somewhat different approach here, which actually starts to get us in the social science kind of mode. And the idea here is that you want social science to be kind of an instrument of legislation, where there's a sense in which you're trying to pass laws that are going to benefit people, but you're not exactly sure what the benefits are going to be until you actually pass the laws, right? And this is where the greatest good for the greatest number comes in. This is understood as kind of an empirical principle, right? So in other words, I'll put forward a law as a hypothesis, essentially, right? I'm going to say, well, I think maybe if we put laws that restrict the number of hours that people can work in factories, right, they'll be better off. They'll live longer, they'll be able to use their lives better, etc., etc. Is this true? Is this false? How do I know? Let's try it out. Okay? And so you think of it as from an experimental standpoint, and then you've got kind of a general standard by which you measure the impact, which is this greatest good for the greatest number stuff. And the whole point about it being done through legislature, through parliament, right, is that parliament is elected. So there's a sense in which, through the electoral process, you have periodic tests, in effect, of legislation as a hypothesis. Right, this is the way utilitarians think about this stuff. And you know, and it seems to me that this is very much the general framework within which social science influences policy. And of course, it's a complex story because unlike the laboratory, where you can, as it were, isolate the conditions and test each of the hypotheses separately, perhaps, with legislation you're always testing a lot of things at once, and they have interacting effects, right? And of course, these are the things, this is what we usually mean by like a party platform, right, of certain parties in government, and it's proposing many different things at once, and so it's moving on many different fronts at once. And of course, as we often see, right, that these different policies have very kind of can perversely interact with each other. You spend too much on one thing, you're starving something else, people aren't taking advantage of initiatives, or they're taking too much advantage of initiatives, and so you have to remedy legislation. And elections provide the opportunity, as it were, to take account of the situation in a regular kind of way, which is something your benevolent despot won't allow you to do. Okay? So this is quite an important move, and this is, and so social science really develops, starts to get, you know, get some kind of legitimacy by being able to inform the legislative process and in a way making legislation kind of more sophisticated. Okay? And indeed, I think one of the things that we find, I mean, there is a lot of rubbish around about dumbing down all the time, right? How people aren't interested in politics and all that. And it's true, voting has gone down, and that is very bad. I haven't, you know, I'm not going to support that. But nevertheless, if you actually look at political discourse and the kinds of things that get politicized and become part of the discussion of policy, it is much more sophisticated and much more fine-grained than it was 100 or 150 years ago. Many more things have entered into it, and a part of it has to do with the development of social science, because as social scientists study more and more things, right, and find more and more phenomena, there is, as it were, more and more things potentially to legislate over. So there's a kind of symbiosis, you might say, between the legislative process and the development of social science knowledge. And you know, this is and the way you really can see this, I think, in a very straightforward way, is the areas of social science that are strong. I mean, God, look at this undergraduate student enrollment. That's another thing, right? I mean, sociology. It's a great example here because sociology, as you perhaps have realized, is the general science of society. So you would think, okay, in this general science of society, all the different parts are created equal, so that there should be equal interest given in terms of research, in terms of student interest, and so forth, to the different sectors of society, because they all need it in order for society to hold together. This is not true. This is not true, of course. And this is where social theory is really living in cloud cuckoo land. But the social theory still operates with the fantasy of that there is a society, right, and that things are happening to society, and that there's a sense in which things are kind of equally affected in society and equally matter in society. But of course, if you look at the development of social science, it's not the case at all. So for example, crime seems to matter a lot. Oh boy, that's a perennial, right? Mike Neary, who is a great maestro of crime in this department, the man goes on leave and the world collapses, right? Because there goes student enrollments. What are we going to do about those crime courses? Are we going to replace them? Are we going to get other people teaching them? How many people are we going to need? Hundreds of students want to take this course every year. Why? Is it because crime is some kind of intellectually profound phenomenon? I don't know. Maybe it is. Okay? But maybe it's because, right, there is a lot of policy interest in this. And that there, as it were, there's a lot of scope for action on this front in many different ways. So we can start messing around with the way kids are raised. We can mess around with the prison system. We can mess around with the police. You know, we can mess around with the medical system to give drugs to these guys who commit crimes, right? We can do all, I mean, there's so many possibilities in terms of legislation and political action on this topic. And moreover, there is a lot of public will in favor of this. That's a very important point, right? Public is quite happy to pay taxes for safety and security. Right? They're quite happy to have politicians go in there. I mean, this is why, you know, this idiot that we have as the Home Secretary, right? This is why this guy's, you know, Blunkett. You know, this is why this man has, you know, he has a kind of a silent majority fan base. Of course, all the intellectuals who write for the broadsheets are always complaining about this guy because he comes across as a Neanderthal. But there is a broad-based kind of support, you know, in the so-called Middle England that actually thinks, this man, he's talking tough, he's being serious, he's trying to address issues, and people are willing to throw money at it. It's very similar in the United States as well, where they cut everything, they'll cut health, they'll cut education, both in terms of funding and in terms of research, but not crime. Crime, people are willing to put more money into crime. Okay? And our sociology curriculum reflects this, right? This is part of the general social phenomenon. All right, and this is something over. I mean, and in a sense, it gives you sense of the balance of power between academics and the rest of society. That our big money spinner is crime, and there's not really much we can do about it other than cultivate it. Right, and it's not just true here. Warwick is by no means alone in this. Okay, I used to be professor at Durham. And Durham also has a big crime thing too, and Durham is a much smaller department, but the crime thing was even more prominent there. And Durham, unlike Warwick, didn't do so hot in the last research assessment exercise. And so what happens in these more desperate universities is you start to get cherry picking, whereby other departments of the university, so the law faculty said, you've got some rather good criminologists there in your sociology department, so we're going to cherry pick them and put them in the law school. Law school's already 5-star, why not have 2 stars, right? And so the point here is that this is a widespread phenomenon, right? And it drives the discipline, right? And it reflects what's happening in society at large. Now, of course, another area that is becoming increasingly important is health. And as you can see, we've got a new medical school now, and virtually every new hire that we've made in this department since I've been here has had some interest in health. Whether they've been the specialists or not, they've had some interest. And there's a larger and larger number of students, both at the undergraduate and graduate level, going into this. Now, again, this is where the research interest is, and it's where the policy interest is. So things, for example, you know, if you want to talk about areas which are sort of underrepresented and underfunded, they're sort of areas, the kind of areas I'm in, like in sociology of science. Nobody denies that science is very important in all this. But science is seeing that somehow self-regulating, self-governing, we don't need to get the government too heavily involved in trying to micromanage what's going on there the way we have to do with crime and health. And so as a result, there's not a lot of incentive and not a lot of funding, and as a result, not much of a student base either for this kind of subject. It's not because it's not important, but there isn't this kind of immediate connection to the legislative process going on. Okay? So, this is a very interesting phenomenon, and so one has to kind of keep this in mind. It's part of what drives social science. Now, I've been, you know, for the last few minutes, I've been talking about this in maybe what you might regard as a kind of negative way, but I do think that the overall impact of this has been positive. That in a sense, this is kind of how democratization works. Okay, where there's a sense in which as people take greater and greater control of the legislative process, their concerns get projected on many different arenas. And if people are worried about crime and they're worried about health, that then becomes what the research agenda is. Okay, and you don't need to have a Soviet-style Politburo for that to take place. This can happen through ordinary democratic processes in the ways that we've seen happen in the Western countries. Okay? So, and I don't think that's necessarily bad. I think if you want to correct the situation, you have to realize what game you're playing here. That there is a sense in which, if we think that social science has been skewed in some fashion, right, we have to start making arguments that go against these trends. And so one of the arguments that does not tend to get made, and it's one of the reasons why the social sciences are so market-driven, is that nobody really defends any big idea of society. And of course, people don't even defend the state anymore. And so all of these larger macro social entities that were traditionally kind of the centerpiece of social science theorizing in the 19th and early 20th century just don't have many defenders on the ground anymore. Of course, you can always drag in 19th century corpses to do the talking for you, but that's only so persuasive, right? So there isn't a lot. So there aren't a lot of very strong defenders of the kind of sense of society that, let's say, Emil Durkheim took as given, right? And I think it's really important here when you look at somebody like Durkheim, who's the founding father of sociology as an academic discipline, right? That this guy had his job cut out for him. Right? And, you know, and this is where a little reflexive sociology is very important here. Here's Durkheim, right, operating in the beginning of the Third Republic in France. You know, the first thing that Third Republic did, right, this was, the end of the last gasp of the Napoleonic wheeze, right, and the end of the monarchy in France, once and for all. Right, took three republics, but they finally nailed the coffin down on the monarchy. And what happened then was you had a completely different, this was also the opportunity to divest all of the old monarchical remnants, the most important of which was the Catholic Church as being the foundation of the monarchy. If you have a monarchy, you don't need to have the Catholic Church legitimating it. And so what happens was that the Catholic Church lost its kind of primary role in the educational system. And in fact, what you started to get was an entirely secularized university system, education system in general, and a consolidation of the nation state, understood in the context, remember, right, the Third Republic is born at the time when France is in this major war with Germany, the Franco-Prussian War, which France loses abysmally. And so France realizes that it's got to sort of reconstitute itself, it's got to sort of reorganize, it's got to kind of get its act together. And so there's an enormous literature that is taking place in the third and fourth quarters of the 19th century in France about degeneration, decadence, that we've got to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps. We need what Durkheim called moral education. Right? Moral education. Now, and this is what sociology was going to provide. Okay? And, you know, the word sociology to describe this is very rhetorically important. Not just because it's referring to kind of the society as a consolidated whole, but because of the echoes with Auguste Comte. Right? Auguste Comte, the man who coined the word sociology, the man who coined the word positivism, and basically saw the two pretty much synonymous. Okay? Auguste Comte was one of these guys who basically believed in the scientific reconstitution of society on a rational basis, whereby science replaces the church as the primary means of legitimation. And he imagined this in a very literal fashion, namely taking over the institutional shell of the Roman Catholic Church. Because the Roman Catholic Church being, you might say, the standard bearer for the idea of a universal belief system that actually has some pretense to global coverage, right? Not only because it was dominant in so many countries in Europe, but also because of the missionary work. And you think about what the Catholic Church was about, right? It's a big enterprise, really the original global enterprise. And so the idea would be that science would take up the institutional structure of the church, right? So in this respect, Comte was not a Protestant by any means, because, right, the whole Protestant thing against the church was that it was this global centralized thing, and what the Protestants were talking about was kind of, you know, privatizing religion, either to the community or maybe even just to your soul, right, depending on what flavor of Protestantism you were. But the point was, they were very much against the globalization, centralization aspect of the Catholic Church. But this is what Comte liked, right? He liked that, and he wanted science, which also has these kinds of centralizing, globalizing aspirations as a universal form of knowledge, right? A la the Enlightenment view of science, wanted it to take it over institutionally. Okay? So that's the Comtean strategy. Okay? This was considered very subversive. Right? Because, you know, here we have the early 19th century Europe. We've got all of the sort of right-minded liberal people trying to fight back the church, push it back to Vatican City where it belongs, and maybe the Italians, right? But that's about it. We don't want it interfering with the government in any serious way in secular countries. And here's Auguste Comte now saying, ah, the solution is to turn science into the church. Right? From the standpoint of the liberals who were using science as a way of beating back the church, this was diabolical, what was being suggested here. And so Auguste Comte was a guy who was regarded as kind of a, you know, weirdo. And he never held an academic post. And basically, he conducted his business as a kind of cult. I think that's what we would call it now, a kind of big cult, you might say. But a kind of a semi-respectable cult. I don't know, maybe like the Church of Scientology, where you have Tom Cruise and semi-respectable people like, because, you know, Comte had some serious friends, and one of them was John Stuart Mill. John Stuart Mill took Comte seriously and kind of presented a kind of domesticated version of positivism to the British market, which sold in Britain. But the point here was the word sociology was tainted by Comte. Okay? You know, here's this wild-eyed guy who's thinking about scientifically reconstituting society on the model of the Catholic Church. You know, and you know, I guess, you know, if you were in the 20th century, what would you think of Trotsky, maybe? Right? Global communism. Again, for weirdos, even within the socialist movement. In a sense, that's kind of what Comte was like with regard to people who considered themselves scientifically minded. He was out there, just like Trotsky's out there if you're a socialist. Maybe not so much anymore because he's the last socialist alive, right? It's Trotsky, right? No one else is a socialist. But the point was, it's like that. It's kind of that kind. So sociology is a very tainted word by the time, you know, you get to sort of respectable, polite academic company. And so John Stuart Mill never liked the word sociology, for example. If he was going to sell this in Britain, he wasn't going to sell it as sociology. He was going to call it moral science. Right? The thing here is that when Durkheim reappropriates the word sociology at the end of the 19th century, this is kind of an interesting rhetorical move, right? Because one of the things that it indicates very strongly is that there is a very proactive, normative, constitutive kind of function for this discipline. This is a discipline that means business. We are going to get the state together. We are going to constitute the society as an organic whole. Right, and that is very much part of what, you know, the scientific reconstitution of society. Okay, Durkheim wasn't saying you have to do this at the global level, but he said we could do it at the national level. Okay, and that's pretty important. That's a pretty important point. And that actually gave sociology its legs. It was that move. And sociology was originally taught, of course, not the sociologists, because there weren't any around. Right. See, when you think about origins of these disciplines, you've got to be sensible about this, right? That there is no automatic market for this. So you have to figure, what already existing market can I put this new discipline in? So, for example, psychology as a science originated, for the most part, in philosophy departments and some medical faculties. They already existed. So where is sociology? In the School of Education. Okay, because you think about what is Durkheim thinking about here. He's talking about the way in which the society reproduces itself as some kind of organic whole, where people have a kind of common collective understanding of what the society is about. And where do you want to target that message to get it across in the most effective way? The teachers. Right? Because the teachers are the people on the front line of social reproduction. They are getting each new generation of people at the primary and secondary school level, and they are basically feeding them whatever nonsense is going to form the backdrop against which they conduct their adult lives. And Durkheim wants to be there when the nonsense is happening. Right? And that's what this whole sociology stuff's about. It's this kind of moral education. Okay? And so Durkheim's first chair is not a chair in sociology, it's a chair in education. Okay? And this is an incredibly important moment in which to have such a chair, given the state of France at that point. Right? So again, go back to 1870, Third Republic, France has got to reconstitute itself, it's gotten rid of all the monarchs, it's lost the war to Germany, it's got to pull itself up by its bootstraps. Education becomes incredibly important in a way it wouldn't perhaps not be if you had a society which is moving perfectly well on its own momentum. So here was an opportunity to ask some very fundamental questions, you might say, about the way in which the society is constituted. Now in Britain, as you may know, over the last 10, 15 years there's been this debate over the national curriculum in here. And one of the reasons why this has gotten animated in a way has a lot to do with immigration, right? It has a lot to do with the introduction of people from, as you might say, non-traditionally British backgrounds, right? In a sense, their representation in primary and secondary schooling. And so you get a big move not only among fundamentalist Christians but also among Muslims about having ethics or, you know, something that might be religious but won't be called religious, right, into the national curriculum. And this is what's a kind of new moment. It shows the society is moving into a new terrain. We have to sort of rethink how do we understand ourselves as a whole. Well, see, my point is that this is the space in which Durkheim was moving. And this is why the whole idea of sociology as the science of society had a kind of gripping character to it, right? Now one place, you know, if you had to think about, well, where did Durkheim, where did this kind of notion of sociology resonate? Well, to a certain extent, it resonated in the United States, okay, in terms of sort of nation-building aspects of the United States. And one of the ways in which you see this happen is that if you look at a lot of the early sociology textbooks, see, first of all, I think one thing you have to realize about the United States is that there is a very strong sympathy for a kind of general Comtean viewpoint in the United States, and even a Hegelian idealistic viewpoint. In other words, these kinds of progressive movements, right, where we're talking about history moving in a certain direction and one wants to be sort of on the vanguard, at the cutting edge, being where the action is. Because, of course, America is the promised land, right? Manifest destiny, America's going to rule the world. It wasn't ruling the world yet in the 19th century, to be sure. I mean, it was only in 1850 that America, that the United States reached to the other Pacific coast after the Mexican War, right? So it's only 1850 the United States actually covers the whole continent that we think of it as associating with it. But nevertheless, there was this view that in the long term, that this is where America was heading. And people who supported this kind of very nationalistic kind of viewpoint tended to like Comteanism and Hegelianism and all these kind of dynamic movements which were always talking about vehicles of history, right, on the global scale. Now, I think one thing that to keep in mind in the context of this is that this business that's happening in the United States is against the backdrop of a country that also at the same time has a very strong anti-big government tendency. So in other words, very strong sense of state sovereignty, state autonomy in the individual states in the country, right? So there's a sense in which these people who wanted to argue the nationalistic line, that America's one big country, not just 50 states, right, had their work cut out. They had to make a really strong argument that there was something that America as a country stood for that was above and beyond just the individual states, which already had quite a lot of autonomy because of the way the constitution of the country set up. So this kind of, in a way, kind of led to a kind of boosting of this kind of nationalistic sentiment, which the social sciences were very keen to promote for largely progressive reasons. Right, so if we're talking about who are these very nationalistic kind of guys, right, they are progressive people for the most part, the internationalists. And so they are the people, for example, who are welcoming an open immigration policy to the United States. As you know, America took in loads of immigrants in waves at various points, especially in the 19th century. But the idea, of course, was we take all these immigrants in, but America is a melting pot. Now remember that metaphor is a very significant metaphor because, again, you can start to see where the job for sociology is, right? Because you've got these people from these multiple backgrounds who come from these kind of disparate cultures, religions, whatever, right? And now we're going to give them new identities. They're going to get melted down into this mass of Americana, Okay? And so that's the context in which sociology has an enormous amount of pull in the United States, okay, in that kind of nation-building project. And you see it happening at many different levels. So you see it, for example, happening obviously at the kind of big theoretical level. I mean, there are guys like Lester Ward and William Graham Sumner. I mean, these are people before Parsons. I mean, we often think about American sociology starting with Parsons. But Parsons, what he did was he established sociology as an academic discipline that in a sense was a formal social science. But in terms of sociology as this kind of general term that could be used to cover a wide range of academic social science research pursuits, that was already being pursued. And it was being pursued with a very strong kind of progressivist but nationalistic agenda. So if you want to think about, you know, champions, you know, people like Theodore Roosevelt or Woodrow Wilson, these kinds of guys, who were both internationalist, nationalist, and progressive guys all at the same time. They were operating on many different fronts. So that was, and American social science, generally speaking, had this kind of cast. So if we look at, like, the kind of economics that was very strong in the United States, some of this institutionalist economics, which is very much concerned about labor-management relations, right, and setting up sort of a stable foundations for negotiating between various classes to sort of, as it were, recognize but also but in some way mitigate conflicts between different groups in society as the society gets larger and more diversified. And within sociology, what you start to get is you get a big growth of what's called the social problems literature. This whole business, I mean, this is where the crime and the health and all this other stuff kind of originates from, is the idea of social problems. Now, the idea of a social problem, right, presupposes you've got a society that could have some problems. Again, it sounds like a trivial point, but, you know, problems are relative to something, right? That, you know, problems just don't exist in a vacuum, right? You don't have social problems unless you have society. No society, no social problems, right? And this is one of the beautiful things about crime. It's one of the few signs around today that people still believe we live in a society, is that people think crime is the problem. It's not just your person. You know, crime isn't just an unfortunate transaction between you and the burglar, right? But rather, it's some systemic issue, right, that requires, you know, institutional treatment. Prisons, police, you know, maybe a few well-placed hypodermic needles, you know, right? But if you don't, but, you know, you can imagine a world, right, where the idea of society has just become so non-existent that crime loses its conceptual meaning, right? In which case, then, you got the kind of situations like those guys in Waco, Texas, right? Remember the Branch Davidians, right? Where, you know, I'm there with my guns on my farm, and that's as much police as I want. And if you step on the line, I'm going to blow your brains out. And you know. And you can bring your gun too. You can blow my brains out first. God bless you, right? And that's the world. Okay? There's no crime in a world like that. Right? There's no crime. Because there's no prior notion of society. There is no kind of regulative legal system against which one can call something a crime. Doesn't exist. Right? So the idea of social problems is not a trivial concept. I reinforce this because I think we may be heading on the way out of social problems. And indeed, there, you know, one of the things that's been very funny about postmodernism, as you know, postmodernism is always subverting all of these tried and tested modern ideas, right? And postmodernists have been, you know, I've been so far making it look as though it's just a lot of right-wing libertarian lunatics who are against the idea of social problems, and we shouldn't underestimate their significance, though. But there are also postmodernists, many of whom are also right-wing libertarian lunatics as well. It's just that they have forgotten what the ideological spectrum means. But the point is, postmodernists always try to deconstruct the idea of problem, right, because it presupposes some kind of hypostatized notion of society, right, which implies a kind of systemic relationship between things that is a pure myth or doesn't seem to exist in any kind of straightforward way. And moreover, when we talk about problems, we're stigmatizing groups of people. For example, criminals. Criminal is a very prejudicial term, you know. It is discriminating against people who perhaps come from disadvantaged backgrounds, because you think about that the population of criminals, right, is not equally distributed among people in society. Okay? And this word criminal gets used a bit indiscriminately, and it ends up being used to stigmatize certain kinds of people. The criminal element, right? Especially if we talk about potential criminals. Right? Because, of course, part of the whole agenda of dealing with crime as a social problem is to prevent it. And how do you prevent it? You identify the people who are most likely to commit it. And, of course, they are from certain socioeconomic, racial groups. Age groups as well. Young people, for example. And so what you got to do is you got to deal with those guys in a special way. Now, see, if you're some kind of postmodern, you go, whoa, there's, you know, what's going on here? This is stigmatizing. I want identity politics. Right? No. Are you kidding? That concept doesn't even exist anymore. I've been trying to tell you. No, but the point is, so what you need is identity politics. You need positive valoration. You know, you valorize in a positive way these people who are being stigmatized by the social problems literature. Right? Now, if you think that this is a little far-fetched with regard to crime, you look at issues like disability. You look at the health realm. Right? What, mentally retarded people? Oh, no, sorry. That's a disablest. You're being disablest when you say stuff like that. Okay? So the point here is, what you end up having, see, one of the things about the whole social problems perspective, and I'm not by any means defending it as a whole, but one of the things important about it conceptually is that it presupposes the notion of society in the whole, and it presupposes certain kinds of normative ways in which people relate to each other. Now, when you get rid of that, and you start to say, no, there are just these different groups of people in society who sort of interact with each other, either more or less recognizing each other in the appropriate way, which is kind of the way we're going with postmodernism, it's not clear what this adds up to. Right? It's not clear what this adds up to. It's not clear what the normative structure of these relations between these groups are. It's just completely open. It's just not there. And regardless of the fine political intentions of the people who push this line, what it does is it does play into a lot of the kind of neoliberal, right-wing kind of thinking that's going on in society now. It plays right into it. Okay? And in any case, from the standpoint of the issues that concern us here, it kind of really undermines the need for a science of sociology. Right? That's really kind of the punchline from the sort of intellectual epistemic standpoint, is if there is no society that's an object of your inquiry, literally there's no society, there are just these groups that are self-recognizing, okay, then what's the point? Right? Emmanuel Wallerstein, a historical sociologist, a world system theorist, he convened almost 10 years ago Gulbenkian Commission on the Future of the Social Sciences. I'm actually part of the second version of this. The first version came out with a little book that some of you might be interested in looking at. And it's called Open the Social Sciences. It was published in 1996. It's a small book. It's kind of like a little, you might say, the summation of what the commission came up with. Basically, looking at the future of the social sciences in light of the last 200 years of its existence, focusing very strongly on the issues I've been talking about here, about the need for an object, society, and how that was anchored historically, and how the moorings of that concept have kind of drifted away, as, for example, the state has come to lose its force as a political entity, and not just as a political entity, but also as a kind of an object of the political imagination, you might say. Right, where you don't have people defending it anymore. I mean, if you think about the 19th and 20th centuries, right? People were proud to be nationalistic, right? Nation building, nation states. These were kind of seen. Of course, there are people who were very suspicious of these things. I'm not denying that. But the point was that people with a straight face could defend these things, and they could defend them under many different ideological rubrics. And so, if you look at, for example, somebody like Max Weber. Now, Max Weber is a very interesting case in all this because this guy's definitely a defender of the German nation state, but he didn't want to enter into the constitution of sociology as a discipline. So Weber, I mean, one of the things about Weber, I mean, I think it's a very important point to keep in mind, because sociology is a really Sociology is a field that has a very self-serving relationship to its history, let's put it that way. Much more so than a lot of other social sciences, especially given that sociology thinks of itself as being historically sensitive. See, economists don't think of themselves as being historically sensitive, so it's not surprising they have a self-serving sense of their history. But sociologists actually think they know history, which is where the problem is. Because you get the impression, looking at sociology, history of sociology, the way it's taught, let's say, in the first year course, that guys like Weber and Durkheim were in some sense in the same discipline, the same field, were talking about the same problems, they were in some sense, if not literally, at least intellectually in dialogue with each other, that they hold complementary views, you know, structure, agency, you know, all this kind of nonsense that gets promoted. I mean, these people had nothing to do with each other. Like, the bottom line is they had nothing to do with each other. This is a figment of Talcott Parsons' imagination that then has gotten reproduced over the decades since the 1930s. And of course, Anthony Giddens has been the one who really launched this into the stratosphere. But it is a really poor way of understanding what sociology has been about. Because in the case of Weber, Weber and the whole German, what we call the German sociological tradition, were very allergic to the word sociology. Precisely because the word sociology had this French thing going on, right? Durkheim, right, he's very normative. He's up front. He's a man who says, look, my knowledge is serving the interest of consolidating this nation state here. You know, and my research is going toward trying to better society, and I'm here to teach these teachers. So I got my normative card on the table, right? Durkheim is a card-carrying member of the French Third Republic, Republican liberal kind of guy, you know, and he's there. The Germans want to keep a distinction between the politics and the science, okay? And in particular, they don't want to be associated at the intellectual level with projects, the politics of which may be subverting the nation state that in fact supports the university system. Okay? And when we talk about the value neutrality of sociology in the Weberian context, this is the big institutional issue here, right? Namely, talking about being able to carve out a sphere of social research that is autonomous from the political activity. So they're not tied together in that kind of integral way that Durkheim wanted. Okay? Largely because, you see, Germany already had something equivalent to what Durkheim was trying to provide for France. And it wasn't happening through social science. It was happening through the humanities. Okay? And so the social sciences, they actually wanted to sort of carve out a niche that was independent of that kind of stuff. And so one of the things that happened, I mean, so you end up getting these internal debates that take place in German social science at the turn of the century, where you basically have one bunch of guys who very much see social science as an arm of social policy and very much part of the state apparatus, who basically think the kind of social science that ought to be done is the stuff that's going to support the state. And so they want it very much, as we would now say, problem-led. Health policy, you know, maybe military policy for international issues, right? But there wouldn't be, as it were, autonomous theoretical agenda. So what these social policy guys were arguing about was looking at, you know, empirical trends, historical trends, but without, as it were, coming up with a kind of autonomous theoretical understanding of that. Whereas Weber's side of the issue, okay, were the guys who said, look, social research is an autonomous sphere, it sets its own problems, has its own methods, and the results of that may indeed be useful in policy, but there is a kind of strict division of labor that takes place between what the scientist does and what the policymaker does. And what somebody like Weber can do is perhaps tell you what your options are, given what our best knowledge is, but doesn't get involved in the policymaking process. So whatever politics you have, and Weber was a very political guy, okay, the politics is independent. It is something else. And this is part of protective coloration. In other words, it's part of a way of protecting social science community in Germany from undue scrutiny on political matters. Even people who were very strong Marxists couldn't get jobs in universities. Social Democrats could, but that's as far as it could go. And if you were active in politics, you were in trouble. You know, if that was influencing your teaching in some substantial way. Okay? Feminists, the whole idea of feminism were seen as too political to be taught in universities even, and in fact there were issues about whether women who were involved in movements to get women the right to vote could actually be academics, whether they were fit to be academics by virtue of having this political interest, kind of like the, you know, and by the way, racist too. They're all in the same category. Feminist, racist, socialist. What's the difference? They're all political troublemakers. Okay? So the point here is that, you know, Weber's kind of carving out a sort of autonomous space. Now, this is quite, you know, this is a quite important thing. Because you can judge this activity in many different ways. Right? You can say, oh, these academics are just sort of protecting their own necks. They don't want to really stick their neck out in a way, you know, the Marxists do and people like that. They're kind of cowards or something, right? But on the other hand, one of the things that this did do, and it's not a trivial point, it's one of the reasons why Weber has remained a very strong, influential figure on many social science fronts, is that it enables social science, if you write social science in a way that is quite separable from any kind of political context, it can be used in many more different ways and it can be developed in many more different directions. I mean, one of the things about reading Durkheim, especially if you read the stuff that he was actually teaching in sociology, is that there you can kind of see the normative aspect very clearly in what he's saying, whereas with Weber it's much more difficult to do. And what this means then is that with Durkheim very often one has to sort of deal with Durkheim on a take it or leave it basis. I mean, you either buy into the basic assumptions about the need for, you know, this solidarity and society and so forth, or you don't, in which case he just doesn't relate to you at all. Whereas Weber, you can deal with him in the bits and pieces, pick and choose, right, in that kind of fashion, because there's a sense in which there's a sort of, for lack of a better word, objectivity, right, to the kind of concepts that can be applied in many different ways. They're not tied to a particular political agenda, or at least the political agenda is not at all very obvious. Now, I think there is, in terms of the politics of Weber's sociology, I do think there is something going on that is quite important. It's not something that would have been particularly controversial, I think, in the context in which he was operating, but I do think it's one of the things that marks him off from Durkheim in a very significant way. And that is, Durkheim enters into the social science arena dealing with a society that had existed for many centuries in a fairly consolidated form already. I mean, France is one of the oldest nation states, okay? However, at the period at which he's writing, it is regarded as being in decline. So what we have is this idea of, yes, there is this organic unity that has existed for many centuries already in place in France, but it's one where the organism is ill, right? The organism is sick, and we've got to sort of restore its health in some way. And this may mean adding some prosthetic devices. So instead of an artificial heart, we give it sociology, right? Whereas in the past, the real heart was the Roman Catholic Church, perhaps, right? You see what I mean? But the point is, we have a sense of an organic unity over time, which Durkheim is inserting himself into as a sociologist. With Weber, we're talking about a different setup here, because remember, Germany as a country, as a nation state, is only born in 1870, right? And Weber is a lawyer by training, and so we're talking about a country that is very self-conscious and very much alive to the fact that it is a constructed entity, right? So the idea of constituting the society is a very important issue for Weber. And so this is one of the reasons why Weber much more easily starts with the ground level, you might say. We've got individuals, and they've had to somehow negotiate their existence together in some fashion. This is why Verstehen matters, right? And you have to somehow build a society up from the ground up, right? And this is kind of the way, if you're thinking about how do you set up a constitution, right? Whether you're talking about Hobbes's Leviathan, right? The state of nature, war of all against all, we decide to have a ceasefire, we're now going to set up a social contract by which we're all going to be binding. This kind of image of the bringing of society into being is very vivid in the German sociological imagination, right? So that in fact, and this is related to the historical context in which sociology arises in Germany, which is in the context of constructing a country. A country that had not, I mean, of course, there were Germans around, and there were lots of German states, and there was a lot of cultural homogeneity amongst these Germans. But there was all kinds of things to negotiate about, trade relations in particular, right? There were negotiations about political structures, right? homogenizing administrative apparatus. That's the kind of stuff that really had to get worked out, and got worked out over several decades. And that's the kind of context in which Weber sociology is coming from. So this is why there's a lot of discussion in Weber about economic relations, the social status of economic relations, how do you get legal entities out of corporations, things of that kind. He spends a lot of time worrying about this, right, in a way in which Durkheim doesn't. Okay, and so this is, so there's a sense in which the concrete political context of where Weber is operating is making a big deal to how he conceptualizes sociology. So that sociology, in the end, for Weber, isn't like a master theory. You might say with Durkheim, it's kind of like a master theory of organic solidarity, collective representations, and you know, and society, as it were, is subsumed in the kind of paradigm of social thinking. Right? It's kind of the way you get it says from Durkheim. But Weber's not like that. With Weber, it's more like a toolkit approach, right? We've got ways in which societies are constituted out of different bits and pieces. Okay, and that's kind of the way his work, and so it's, but it's not surprising given the context in which he's operating. You know, and here it's, I think, important to realize that the founder of the German Sociological Association, Ferdinand Ternis, the guy who wrote the Gemeinschaft und Gesellschaft, right, Community and Society, right, his reputation was a translator of Hobbes. Okay, that's where the man got his, because remember, again, we have to think about what are these people doing before sociology actually exists? These are the guys making sociology. What is, you know, what is, where are they coming from to make sociology, right? And so, in the case of Ternis, and again, a person with a legal background, right, who's very interested in the state of nature and how you get contracts out of this, you know, and how this leads to states, right, that have some kind of stability, right? And if you look at it, not only in Ternis but also in Weber, the great fascination with the state of the artificial person, which is what the Leviathan is in Hobbes, that maintains its authority through power. The monopoly of force. Is, you know, with Weber, the ultimate authorization of the state is the monopoly of force, which over time gets kind of rationalized through bureaucracy and all these other things that you guys would study about in your introductory course on Weber, right? But that's where it's coming from. It's coming from this kind of Hobbesian legacy of how you construct a nation state, thinking about Germany as a recently constructed nation state. And of course, the construction of Germany as a nation state in 1870 is something that people had been talking about for years, right? And there are stages along the process through the 19th century that would have been part of the kind of common history that these German sociologists could draw on. So you have the kind of customs treaties that took place that allowed free trade relations within the German-speaking world, right? You had all these different things, you know, treaties whereby they wouldn't attack each other, or they would be on the same side if someone attacked one of them. I mean, all these things were part of the build-up to the consolidated nation-state of Germany. And that would be part of the backdrop against which sociology would be constructed as a science. Okay? So, all this is important. So, what I'm saying here is that the Durkheim context and the Weber context for the origins of sociology are really radically different. The difference between, on the one hand, a long-standing society that has a certain kind of organic unity that is seen in decline and has to get revived normatively versus a state that is being constructed, right, legally, a quite self-consciously artificial entity, right, which requires the constant negotiation and cooperation of people. So, when you move into the history of sociology in the 20th century and you start looking at a lot of these micro-sociologists, right, they are very often picking up on the Weber legacy, right? The Verstehen stuff, the fact that you're starting sort of at the ground level. That is very important. Because this is, and now, admittedly, these micro-sociologists are talking about things that Weber never talked about. Because one of the things about Weber, in a way, much more than Durkheim, actually, but Durkheim, too, to a certain extent, is they're still old humanists in one very important way, and that is they're still only interested in important things. Right? I mean, you're not going to hear, for example, where are women in these guys? Women aren't very important, so they're not talked about by Weber or Durkheim. Okay? That's a very important point, right? So what these guys are really interested in is they're interested in the modes of legitimation. So they're interested in the big stuff, right? They're interested in, you know, the economy, right? But they're not interested in the household economy. They're not talking to you about what's happening in the kitchen and unpaid labor of housewives and things like that. That kind of stuff, which is now very popular to study, they're not talking about that. No, they're talking about corporations. They're talking about capitalism, right? They're talking about the big stuff, what the big boys do, right? You know, it's from that standpoint, right? And they're very interested in the law, right? The guys are very interested in the law, and not just because of crime, but they're interested in the way the law works, legal structures, judges, legislators. They're very fascinated with stuff like that. Okay, and they're very fascinated with religion as a form of regulation. So they like to talk about priests, right? And they like to talk about, you know, again, these big guys who are kind of controlling the show. And that's kind of how they see society, right? And this is, and, you know, that even a guy like Weber, who in a sense imagines society as very much constructed from the ground up, right? The individuals that he's concerned with are not ordinary individuals like a micro-sociologist would be today, but rather, you know, like the individual guys who negotiate a treaty, which sets up, you know, a peace accord, right? That's what the individuals he's concerned about, right? So this is quite important. This is quite an important point because it really, in a way, shows the degree to which there's still a very strong humanistic residue, right, where the humanities is just concerned with the important stuff, the big stuff, right? And as it were, most of the actual stuff doesn't get talked about at all. Right, so here's Durkheim and Weber telling you about the nature of society and the fundamental concepts for understanding social life. But where are they, what are they drawn from? You know, I mean, how much of actual social life is picked up on all this? You see, and this is where it turns out there's a lot of work to do in the 20th century for social science. Right, namely, actually making good on the promise. You see, and part of this has to do also with the fact that sociology, you know, even in Weber, but certainly in Durkheim, is functioning in a kind of normative capacity, right? Where in a sense, part of the game is to regulate. So there is a top-down aspect is sort of there. But when you get later on in the 20th century, people start to take more seriously this idea that everybody in society matters, and not only matters from the standpoint of having the right to vote and being involved in the political process, but also matter as objects of study. And not only objects of study because we're interested, you know, in controlling them, though of course that's actually paying the bills. I mean, let us not, again, a little moment here on ethnography, my favorite subject, is that ethnography, of course, has been very important in doing this business of giving people voice. This business of giving people voice, right? All these, the great unwashed, the silent masses, all these people who don't figure in the pages of Durkheim and Weber and the classical sociologists. We've got ethnographers in the field, right, who write about these people and try to give them voice, okay? This is a wonderful thing to do, right? And so you get the female voice, and you get the black voice, and you get all these voices, right? Now, who's paying for all this, right? Again, you have to ask who's paying for it. Obviously, the people talking aren't paying for it, right? It's the people who want to hear them, right? And so the client base, of course, is like the Rockefeller Foundation, you know, or the Ford Foundation, or someone who's got a kind of interest in making sure the natives don't get too restless, right? And so you want to understand how they're thinking. You want to get a sense of how they, you know, how they do things on their own terms so that it becomes easier to negotiate with them. Because after all, if you're trying to get them to do something unpalatable, the last thing you want to do is actually present it that way. Right? What you want to do is, you want to present it as something that they will understand, they will not immediately resist, they might even have the impression it's in their interest. Okay? Now this is not just ethnography, of course. Ethnography, of course, has been very implicated in this. But of course, when we talk about anthropology, right, and I haven't said much about that diabolical science, and talk about a science that is sort of dying because of the loss of client base. Hey, you know, empires die, anthropology goes out the window. I mean, if you look at the death of anthropology in Britain, it's a sight to behold, right? I mean, because, you know, basically, you know, there was this period in, you might say, the middle third of the 20th century, right, when anthropology was everywhere in Britain, right? You know, that last gasp of imperialism. Right, as imperialism is getting liberalized a bit, so you start having a more complex interest in the natives than you used to, right? So, you know, and that was the great moment. And then when imperialism ends, okay, anthropology dies, or it turns into cultural studies, which is, you know, so what it does is it sort of implodes. right? And so the idea of anthropology being about reading texts in a funny way, well, it certainly saves a lot of money from having to go to the Sudan, right? Especially nowadays, right? But that's a very important point, because if you look at the key moments in anthropology where a lot of, and this is very important from the standpoint of the philosophy of social science, because the key examples, when you know, philosophers trot out these examples of relativism, different cultures have different ways of looking at the world, and these things are in some sense radically different, right? That you cannot come up with some universal principles that could cover the reasoning of all the different cultures, right? The examples are precisely these anthropological examples. I mean, by the time philosophers work through them, right, they become very abstract and artificial, but they are actually based on real anthropological case studies. Okay? So in this respect, the philosophy of social science is like second-order reflection on anthropological fieldwork. I think that's not an unfair thing to say. So if you look at people, for example, like Evans Pritchard, okay, Edward Evans Pritchard, he's very important because he, in the 1930s and 40s, he did these two very important field work in Sudan, the Nuer, N-U-E-R, and the Azanding, A-Z-A-N-D-E. Okay, and these are very famous tribes of Sudan. Philosophers know them especially. I don't know if anyone else would know much about them, but because they're the kind of, because these are tribes with very wacky practices, right, that seem to defy the laws of logic and so forth. And so philosophers will trot this out and say, well, what are we going to make of this? Here are these people thinking they're descending from birds or something. I mean, what is going on here? Right, and Edward and Evans Pritchard, right, when he writes about this stuff, he presents it straight. He presents it, these are their beliefs. This is what they hold. I'm just reporting the facts, man. You know, this is good. You know, this is what they believe, and they seem to function perfectly fine that way. Right, that's always the kicker, right? Here's the story, and it works. You figure it, right? The philosopher's looking at this saying, now, there's got to be something wrong here. He must be misdescribing what's going on, or they're not really doing what they say they're doing, right? And so you get all kinds of theories about how do you supposed to decode what these primitives are up to, because they can't be literally doing what they say they're doing or thinking what they say they're thinking. There must be something else happening, right? And so this is how you get all this discussion about relativism and so forth, right? Is this appearance of a radically alternative worldview genuine, or is it in fact a kind of misunderstanding of people doing things kind of like what we would do, it's just they're talking about it somewhat differently? That's kind of the alternatives, right? And so it's very important, you know, the relativism debate is very much grounded on this kind of anthropological stuff. Okay. Now, Evans Pritchard is one of these guys, that, you know, he starts the program Social Anthropology at Oxford, which is where all the colonial administrators are being trained. And the key thing about him, and this is one of the things that distinguished him from a lot of his predecessors in anthropology, so we're talking again 1930s and 40s, pretty late in the imperial period. Right, from let's say distinguishes him from let's say Malinowski, Bronislaw Malinowski, who founded anthropology at the LSE, which was where it first started in this country. When he went into the field, and you know the Trobriand Islanders and their interesting sex practices and economies and things like this. When he went there, he always had interpreters. He was, you know, the great white anthropologist with the pit helmet, surrounded by natives who were translating for him and carrying his bags as well. And you the famous pictures of him doing this kind of thing. And you see him sitting in the tent, smoking his pipe at night, pondering the mysteries of the natives, right? And recently his correspondence has been published, you know, where he writes to his wife telling him, boy, it's hot here, you know, or something like that. You know, and you get a sense of how the man thought. But the interesting thing about him and about these people from the generation prior to Evans Pritchard is they didn't learn the original languages of the people they were studying. They didn't master, they had the natives there helping them out. Right, the natives would cooperate for various reasons. And that was the standard practice, right? So, you know, what you as an anthropologist, what you needed was sensitivity, patience, an education in Latin and Greek, you know, but that was about it, right? You didn't need to actually know any languages of the people you were studying, right? You just had to be a clever bloke, right? That's pretty much what you needed to do. Evans Pritchard changes this. He basically says you need, actually, to learn those native languages, and we're going to teach them to you at Oxford, right? Here you see a very close fit with certain kinds of needs of the late imperial period. Because one of the things that's happening by the time you get to the 1930s and 40s, and remember we're talking about Africa here, we're talking about the Sudan, is we're worried about World War II. We're worried about the Germans mounting an offensive here, right? And as you know, the old desert fox, Rommel, he was roaming around down there at the time, okay? And the British were very worried. British were the ones who were they were the imperialists in Sudan, but the Germans were making some moves in Africa, and there was a concern that these Sudanese might be convinced that, in fact, the British were not in their best interest, because here, after all, Britain had been this imperial power, not always doing everything marvelously. There were some very famous battles, for example, where a lot of native Sudanese died, and so there, you know, it might not be too hard to persuade these Sudanese that they ought to go to the German side, which would be a complete disaster from a from a logistical standpoint if you're trying to fight World War II. So you definitely need to have the natives on your side. Now, how are you going to do that? Well, you have to gain their confidence, right? And it doesn't make any sense. And in fact, it's not really in your best interest to just go in there as the great English speaker, you know, with a bunch of natives who happen to have bought out, bribed. You know, this is like Iraq, right? I mean, this is what's happened with Iraq. That's why Iraq doesn't work, right? Because you got Americans bribing a couple of Iraqis, and you're supposed to believe these jokers is running a country peacefully? I don't think so. Well, the British were worried about this in the Sudan, that basically if they relied just on interpreters who were natives, they would just be seen as flunkies for the British. And they wouldn't have, and they wouldn't necessarily be gain their confidence in this very tricky, delicate political situation, much trickier than before. Because see, when the British were the only ones controlling Sudan and nobody wanted to challenge them, the British could do whatever they want, basically, right? I mean, just, you know, nobody's competing. But, and of course, Sudan, as you know, enormous desert, who'd want it, right? Except for military reasons, if you're marching armies back and forth. Okay? And that was the key point when we're talking about the 30s and 40s. We're talking about the prospects of a world war, and in fact, a world war happening during some of the period where Evans Pritchard is down there. So what this does then is it creates, on the part of the anthropologists and the people hiring them, a more intensive interest in understanding the natives from the inside, getting to figure out what makes them tick. Because in order to govern them effectively, you're not going to be able to rely on the traditional, more external ways of dealing with them, through mediators and things like that. Rather, you have to actually get into their souls. You have to be able to sort of gain their confidence in a deep kind of way. And so being able to speak with them and live amongst them and be able to persuade them that you actually understand and you appreciate the way they approach the world will be very vital for gaining their confidence. Right? Not necessarily because you want to get something out of them specifically. Right? Rather, you just don't want them to switch sides. Right? It's not like the British, you know, in some way were trying to, get something more out of the Sudanese that they were already able to get out of them. Rather, they just didn't want them to shift allegiances. They didn't want them to go to the other side. They wanted to keep their loyalty. And so to do that, you have to actually persuade the people that you really take them seriously. You really appreciate how they think. You really respect what they're up to. And see, this is where this relativism becomes really important. You know, if you think like the relativist, then you know you say, wow, these people have a different worldview. I got to take this seriously. I got to learn their languages. I got to figure out how they think about the world, and I got to take this with deadly seriousness. Then you will, in fact, be able to gain their confidence. Okay? You will gain their confidence. They will remain on your side, and that's in fact what happened. It worked. It worked. Okay? It's this business of going deep cover, right, as they say, into all of these cultures. So what you end up getting from this, right, is you get a kind of finer kind of control, a finer grain kind of control taking place. It's not this kind of external form of control whereby you have, as it were, the native, the guys you buy out doing all the work for you, the sort of Alawis of the world, right? You don't have that, right? Rather, you yourself get involved. You immerse yourself. You yourself are there, and you deal with them. And what Evans Pritchard managed to succeed in doing, I think, as a kind of literary accomplishment, you might say, is to actually present these seemingly very crazy views in a completely sensible fashion. And this is what it made it so interesting and intriguing for philosophers. Because this guy is writing about it straight. Right? And he's writing it and that's probably the way you had to think about it in order for it to work effectively as a colonial strategy. Okay, so this is really, I think, quite important, quite profound sort of thing. Now, of course, when the need for this disappears, right, when there's no longer any kind of strategic political reason for taking the Sudanese that seriously, then, of course, everybody pulls out, anthropology departments die, and look what's happening to Sudan now, right? I mean, you know, and, you know, easy come, easy go. It's as straightforward as that. And so whole academic disciplines and whole methodologies, right, which of course we can always discuss in a very abstract way, have these very, very particularly rooted, historically, sociologically rooted character to them, and when the rooting disappears, when the need to have this disappears, the practices disappear too. Okay? And this is why, you know, all this discussion now about the United States staying the distance in Iraq, you know, and Afghanistan, and if it invades Iran, there too, God knows what else, right? How this will require such a massive change in the way one thinks about other cultures. Because, see, the United States thinks about other cultures pretty much like a business person does. You know, namely, they've got things we want, we may have some things they want. If we could set up a trading environment, boom, that's as much intervention that I want. You know, so if I can get those big companies in there, they can conduct business, whether it be oil or whatever, that's all the infrastructure we want. We don't want to kind of get in there in some sort of deep cultural way and influence the way they think and stuff like that. No, so they don't think about it as an anthropologist thinks about it. Think about it more like a business person. But that's not going to work as a global strategy. Okay, especially if you're going to, also, if you add that with militarily interfering in the countries. And so, you know, one, those people who like to see anthropology revived in this very sort of deep kind of relativistic way might look forward to the day if we go back to an empire, you know, and we start to get a kind of deep interest in all these countries that we're, you know, sort of promiscuously invading right and left. You know, if we got real deep interest and we want to start resettling people there and stuff like that, like the old empire people did, then I can see a great revival for anthropology, for relativism, for all these kinds of things coming back into fashion. Because that's kind of what really maintains it as something that is reproducible and seen as a very valuable form of knowledge. You see? And so, because, you know, the interesting thing about relativism as an idea is you can treat it as just an idea, right? Imagine, people will, real kinds of weird views. And you can have a sort of philosophical debate about this for 60 minutes, and then people will decide what they will about it and then go home. But the whole idea of thinking about this as a basis for a method, as a way of thinking about other people in a very general kind of way, about what the implications are for how you interact with others, that requires some kind of sustained incentive from the outside. It's not particularly natural. Okay? And that's why relativism in its very robust form only existed in this particular period in the history of social science. And existed, you know, very strongly during that time, and now is fading out. And that's why when you look at postmodernism in contrast to relativism, it depends how you think about postmodernism. But sometimes people think of postmodernism and relativism as the same thing, but they're not in a very important respect. Namely, relativism, as the word indicates, presupposes relativity to something, right? So if we're talking about beliefs are relative to something, usually relative to a culture, that presupposes there is a culture. It's kind of like presupposing there is a society, right? That there is a bounded space where some kind of uniform, homogeneous set of beliefs and practices are happening, and they are different from, let's say, the homogeneous, uniform beliefs and practices that I normally have, right? So there's this clear distinction between them and us, as it were, a very radical distinction, and that it can't be bridged by some kind of saying we really have something in common. It's rather, I go into the other world and I become one in the other world. And that's the whole immersion thing that the anthropologist does. And then I go back out and I'm back in my own world. And there'd be two worlds. And sometimes you may know Peter Berger, the sociologist, uses this word alternating as a strategy, right? That's what he means. You go to one world, you go to another world. Back and forth, right? And that's supposed to be a skill you cultivate when you do certain kind of ethnographic work. Postmodernism differs from this in that the postmodernist doesn't recognize there are these clear boundaries. So the difference between them and us, you and me, from the standpoint of separable beliefs and practices just is not there. And one of the ways you know to think about this is, look, the most natural way to think about relativism is in terms of things like different countries that are, you know, have different languages, right, or different cultures that have very clear geographically bounded spaces. But if that way of organizing people is in some sense dissolving or disintegrating or not as compelling on the imagination as it used to be, right, if we're thinking about people basically mixing around in flows of global character, right, where your affiliations might be with these networks, where your best friend might be 3,000 miles away, you know, this kind of thing. And this is kind of the way the postmodernist sees the world, right, where the connections are not connections that are clearly bounded in space that way, then the idea of figuring out relative to what doesn't make any sense. Okay, and so that's kind of an important point to keep in mind. So what postmodernists do, typically, is they don't tell you things like, they're the sort of people who would valorize learning many different languages to understand many different cultures. Rather, they valorize hybridizing, where you're mixing stuff. Mixing and matching. So everybody speaks a kind of pidgin English now around the world. That's very postmodern. Right? That's very postmodern. Because what you've got there are people, right, who are taking their native languages and are sticking on some English because that English enables that discourse to travel just that much further to get into contact with someone else. But there is no kind of permanent, sustaining, deep kind of connection between these people. There's just the connection that's forged in the interaction. And if you know about the development of language, right, the pidgin, P-I-D-G-I-N, pidgin, that sense of pidgin, right, are the primitive origins of language in trade. Right, so pidgins, I mean, the way linguists explain the origins of language very often is from pidgins to creoles to full-blown languages, and what it means is that you start with trade. There's a trading zone where people who, let's say, come from quite different cultures and speak different languages, nevertheless need to interact with each other for purposes of trading, and then a kind of hybrid language develops that enables the trade to be facilitated. And a lot of the big languages of the world, like Arabic and Swahili, which are spoken by people in many different countries who have otherwise quite different cultural backgrounds, races, blah, 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 religions, all originated as pidgins, as trade languages. They were not languages of a particular country that then spread outward, but rather were languages that were developed as trade languages and then became global in a way. Certainly Arabic is a great example. Arabic may be the best example of that. Okay? And see, that's very postmodern. That's a kind of postmodern conception of culture in a way. It's that kind of hybridized thing where there is no deep connection. There are the connections that are just forged in the interactions, which then spread outward and indefinitely. Okay? So that's very different from the classical sense of relativism. I think that's a very important point to keep in mind. Because, this is why anthropology, in a way, in that kind of classic Evans Pritchard sense of immersing yourself in other cultures, isn't really part of the postmodern scene. That's not really part of the postmodern scene. And that's why the people who still claim to be doing anthropology and call themselves postmodernists aren't really doing what those guys in the imperial period were doing. Okay? Because hybridizing and immersing are two different kinds of activities. Right? And that's, I think, an important point always to keep in mind there. Okay. Well, let's see. Let's see how far we've gotten here. Good stuff. Still moving along. All right. I'm going to turn this off now.